I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
your
has been declined.
Your unemployment benefits ran.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
your
has been declined.
Your unemployment benefits ran out 2 weeks
what
ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I still have checks left. Checks
2 weeks
left.
Ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit, get out of debt, and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
your
has been declined.
Your unemployment benefits ran out 2 weeks
what
ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I still have checks left. Checks
2 weeks
left.
Ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit, get out of debt, and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how, without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
Are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, and for this fabulous February pre-Valentine's Day show, February 12th, 2011, we're broadcasting live from the Log Mahal in Payson, Arizona. And this Saturday, like every Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, we broadcast the Unlock Your Wealth radio program and talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help you get your finances and attitudes in line to create immediate financial wellness today and begin the path for financial freedom for tomorrow, for you and your family's future. And we do that each and every week, one show at a time, one key from our Keys to Riches Financial Wellness series at a time. And this week, I am so excited. Yes, totally, because this is the moment we've all been waiting for. We, for those of you who have been listening since the beginning of the season, have been saving those receipts diligently since the second show of the season. And it is now time for us to gather those receipts together and begin to break the budget. Yes, that is what key we are on this week. is our Break the Budget Key. And for those of you who are not familiar with the process, we liken budgeting to dieting. And dieting is something you go onto and off of, and usually when you come off of a diet, you wind up gaining back all the weight you lost and then some. And the same thing happens with budgeting. We go onto a budget and then we come off of it, usually by circumstance, sometimes self-driven, sometimes by others. But either case, what happens is that we wind up destroying ourselves because we get into even deeper financial ruin than what we started with. So how do we break the cycle? Well, just like fitness trainers and dietitians and nutritionists take and recommend a healthy exercise and eating plan instead, what we advocate is a healthy savings and spending plan. And notice the terminology was aligned in a particular fashion for a particular reason. We said healthy exercise and eating plan because you got to work out first. And then you can nourish the body after you break it down with a fabulous workout. So in that same vein, we, with our finances, break our budget down into a healthy savings and spending plan first. We pay ourselves, number one. Then we spend what's left over. So in today's episode, we are going to learn what we need to be doing to create that savings and spending plan. And if you remember from our second episode when we started our organic assessment, now we are ready to finalize that assessment and create our where I'm at, where am I going, and what's the difference plan. And we're going to learn how these three keys unlock our financial potential by understanding it. We're going to complete our assessment by not only identifying the what in our spending patterns, but the when and the why. And in that will give us the tools we need to create the how do I become financially free. All that is going to occur in the second hour. In addition to that, we have Danny Kopke joining us. And it's perfect because we're going to talk with him about surviving on a teacher's salary. And it's all about choice and perspective. And if you listen to how this guy lives, he lives an incredibly rich, full life. And it's all based on the economic theory of opportunity cost. And so we're going to talk about that all in the second hour. In the first hour, we have an incredible Investor's Edge guest. Rich Arzaga is joining us. He is a financial planner. And we are going to talk about the nuances of estate planning when it comes to people who invest in real estate. Because there's a difference in the way your estate needs to be set up if you would like to pass on your wealth. And because it's a different type of asset, there are different ways that it needs to be structured. So Rich Arzaga is going to be joining us coming up this hour, talking about what it is that we need to know when it comes to financial planning with real estate, and specifically estate planning, and how do we pass that on to our loved ones or to organizations that perhaps we choose to leave our legacies with. So I'm so excited about that. We also have Minutes on Your Money. We have our Millionaire Minutes and so much more on today's show. Plus, our Keys to Riches in the second hour, plus our nuts and bolts with this week's financial strategy. All that, plus the trivia question. Yay, trivia! For those of you that are joining us for the first time, each week we have a trivia question that we base on a previous show, so it pays to be a regular listener. And we take a question from one of our previous shows, and that, for regular listeners, it gives you the edge. However, let's say you're not quite a regular listener or you're new to the show. You want that same edge, don't you? Well, here is some big bang for no bucks. Sign up for our complimentary electronic magazine. Each and every week, Elena DeFiore publishes the electronic magazine for the Unlock Your Wealth Radio program, which gives you tips, tricks, tools, and information on how you can become financially free, as well as the scoops on our upcoming guests and the trivia question. And this is published on Fridays before our show on Saturdays. So if you would like to win fabulous prizes, all you have to do is subscribe to the e-zine to get on the edge up on what you need to know to win these fabulous prizes. Now, this week's trivia question is based on our midweek update from Wednesday. And on Wednesday, we came up with some fabulous tips to create Valentine's gifts on the cheap cheap. Now, if you didn't listen, you could hurry up and go download the broadcast and try to skitter through it and figure out what it is that we talked about. All you have to do is name some of those little savings tips that we talked about. If you name one, I'm good with that. And you can win a personalized copy of my newest book, Bushido Business, or you can choose from this week's guest. And they have, or you can receive a copy of their autographed book. So all you have to do to win is come up with the right answer. And once you think you have the right answer, you can call in, email in, or chat in to win. If you'd like to call in to win, the telephone number is 1-718-508-9002. That's 1-718-508-9002. And you, too, can potentially answer the question correctly. Elena would be happy to take your call and document your answer, and you could potentially receive fabulous prizes worth big bucks. Now, if calling in is not an option, if you are listening from our Blog Talk Radio, please be advised. You can chat in to win. Pop into our chat room, say hello to the other guests listening to the show, swapping stimulating conversation about topics we are talking about, and tell Elena what you think your answer is. Or you can email in to win. Send your answer to trivia at uywradio.com. That's trivia at uywradio.com. So you can call in, chat in, or email in to win. So I am thinking that you need to stay tuned because we have so much more in store coming up on Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. Right after this, we've got Rich Arzaga. So stay tuned for more. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, this is Coca Brown from the hit radio show, The Truth with Coca Brown, on HollywoodOutlaws.com radio. And you're listening to me on Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
Hi, it's Marty Logan here from the Top Gun Sales Academy. You know, one thing I've learned over the years is that the most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Naturally, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, and Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside. They knew they could easily become. Truly, financial coaching could be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation, 1-866-966-9420. That toll-free number again is 1-866-966-9420, or simply visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis. K-I-N-E-S-I-S Industries.com. Like, go there, totally.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. And I am so tickled about this next guest we have coming up, because our Investor's Edge segment is all about taking what you've accomplished in our Financial Freedom series of the Keys to Riches and taking it to the next level in the Master's series. And so your Investor's Edge guest this week is Rich Arzaga. Rich is the founder and CEO of Cornerstone Wealth Management in San Ramon, California. He is a certified financial planner, and he's also an investment advisor representative with LPL Financial. His clientele includes real estate investors, business owners, sole proprietors, business executives, and affluent families. So those are folks just like you. Rich's professional credentials include an investment advisor representative, general securities registrations through LPL Financial, California Life Insurance, and a California real estate broker, among other designations and distinctions. Prior to personal financial planning, Rich served in senior-level positions for 18 years for a cross-section of entrepreneurial, high-growth, and Fortune 500 companies. His role as executive vice president of a technology startup significantly contributed to the business being sold for $326 million. So I would just hazard a guess to say that I believe this man just might know a thing or two about money. Wouldn't you agree? So in addition to all of these credentials, Rich now joins Unlock Your Wealth Radio for our Investor's Edge segment to talk about what you need to know financially when it comes to estate planning as real estate investors. Welcome to the broadcast, Rich. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am well. Thanks so much for joining our broadcast today. And as our Investor's Edge guests, once, you know, our folks get through our Keys to Riches Financial Wellness series and they begin investing in real estate, it's different to make considerations for estate planning and how do we plan to transfer our assets when we pass, or how do we structure
the management of said assets if we are injured or incapacitated and don't die but have to live but aren't able to manage our assets. And with real estate, it's a little bit more tricky than, say, just your stock portfolio, correct?
Yes, exactly. Very much so. You have, whereas a stock portfolio, you have, investments in what's pretty much agreed that is a perfect world or perfect environment. The real estate portfolio is much different because it's not there's not a lot of information on real estate out there. It's every property is different, every tenant is different, every region is different. So it's a very, very different experience than managing a portfolio of stocks and fixed investments.
What is the big difference between a stock and income-producing real estate that makes it so different when you go to do your estate plan?
Well, I think that the biggest difference is going to be liquidity, because when you do your estate planning, and if you have a taxable estate and you have a 100% portfolio in real estate, then when somebody passes, then that real estate, it could be at play in terms of needing to liquidate to pay taxes. So when real estate is subject to liquidation to pay taxes, you know, it could amount to a fire sale. It could amount to a sale during a time like today, at this time when, you know, it wouldn't be the ideal time to sell, where it really is a buyer's market. Whereas in equities, you know, you could go and sell the stocks that you need to go ahead and pay for the estate taxes and not interrupt the balance of the portfolio.
And that's always a killer when it comes to that. If folks are young, you know, life insurance, term life insurance is pretty cheap, and you can use that to offset some of those taxes so you can maintain the investment. But if you're older, it might not make financial sense to try to insure against taxes. What are some ways that folks can shield, if there is a possible way, to shield or lessen some of the, you know, death taxes and that transfer when it comes to this? So future generations do not have to liquidate the property. They can continue to have it make income for them and don't have to worry about what's going on in the market right now, whether or not it's a buyer's market or a seller's market.
That's a great question, Heather. There's a handful of different things that someone could do, an investor can do, with their directly owned real estate to help reduce the estate taxes. One of the easiest ones and most convenient ways is to hold life insurance outside the estate in some sort of irrevocable life insurance trust. So that way, when the death of the second adult or spouse happens, then if taxes are due, you have the liquidity of the death benefit to offset those taxes. So that's one way to cover the taxes, not necessarily reduce them. There are other ways to reduce the taxes. They include strategies like irrevocable trusts, and there are a variety out there. One of the most common ones for real estate is something called a charitable remainder trust, and that's a strategy where an investor puts a property into a CRT, a charitable remainder trust, decides to go ahead and have the trust own it. When the investor passes, the asset
remainder
goes to charity. But while the investor is alive, they get the benefit of the income. If they feel that the beneficiary might miss the benefit of having that asset after the investor passes, they might want to buy some life insurance with some of the income that they're generating from that. But it's a great way to liquidate a property, to buy anything else, including more real estate, and to still have pretty much the full amount of that asset in play without having to pay state and federal capital gains taxes.
Now, I remember when I was teaching real estate, and I haven't taught actively for pre-licensees like I used to in the last couple of years, so I don't know if anything's changed, but I remember on the real estate exam when you had a married couple and one passed away, you had an adjustment to the capital gains.
Yeah.
Now, do you still have that that cost basis adjusted?
Yeah, it really is based. It really is about how the property is titled. So, but in, and it's also based on the state that you're in. So, in some states, the step up in cost basis for that half of the property occurs, like in the state of California. So that's nice. And then you're really left with the, you know, the, what's left is the other half of the step up that's not taken for the surviving spouse. So yes, it, but it depends on titling. If the titling is not done correctly, then you can't take advantage of that sort of, or it's harder to take advantage of that sort of strategy.
And like, how does that titling need to occur? I know how it needs to be languaged here in Arizona.
Yeah, yep, yep. Well, it really is state by state. Well, Arizona is a community property state, and so is California, and so is another, you know, handful or two of states. And it really is state by state. And I think the, probably the best way to answer that, since this is going out there to the country, is to check in with the I'll default to checking in with the CPA to make sure and the estate plan attorney to make sure that titling is done correctly. But it really is unique by state. So that's probably the best way to answer that one. But in general, yeah, you're absolutely right. For many states and many people, when the spouse passes, then that part of the property is stepped up.
You know, last month we had a same-sex estate planning attorney on. And in the states that recognizes legal unions for same-sex couples, is it still not recognized federally, or does it not matter if you're dealing with the same-sex couple? Will they get the step-up in cost basis, or is that still one of the punitive things for being?
God, that's a really good question. I got to tell you, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't want to guess on that one. I have a sense, though, we'll take a whack at it, though. I have a sense that it's not the same as if you're married. I know that some states recognize same-sex couples or domestic partners as married, but I got to tell you, I haven't seen a case go through where somebody is looking for a step up based on a domestic partner's death. So that's mm-hmm. that's a great question. There's an answer.
Well,
out there,
I know,
right?
It's one of the challenges that same-sex couples have, you know, by choosing monogamy. It doesn't benefit them because they're a same-sex couple, and they run into that. Well, one of you is not a man, or one of you is not a woman, and that's one of the biggest challenges. And I didn't know if, you know, states that recognize that would allow that step up for at least at the state level. Probably federally, I don't think it's recognized at this point, since, you know, you can't get other things taken care of. But I didn't know if states that recognized the civil unions, if they allowed that or not.
Yeah. You
know,
I
doesn't happen here in Arizona, but I was wondering if other states might do that.
Yeah, I wish I had a clear answer for you. I have a feeling that there may not be a clear answer for most people out there, but we're just kind of walking through history right now on that sort of question. But, you know, it made me think about a solution for that, and maybe for some areas, for some couples in some parts of the country, having the property for same-sex couples as a tenants in common might do the trick. Because if you think of a tenants in common, it's the each partner in a TIC can go ahead and will out their part of the property, and it's stepped up. So maybe, and again, I would urge...
Oh, versus joint tenants. That makes sense. That's a great idea.
I would urge the investor to go out there and make sure that it works within their area and their own plan. This is not a universal recommendation at all. But you might consider
certainly
a TIC.
Something to explore, though.
Yeah, absolutely right. TIC, and then you will it to the your partner, and that might have the same impact. I'm sure there's something I'm missing on that, but something to explore.
Well, it sounds right. I mean, because they don't say you can't will it to the person that you're living with. It doesn't have to go to somebody else. It can go to anybody you want. So that would make sense. That's kind of an idea, a great way to get around that.
It's a feel-good discussion right now.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Because you should always check how it applies to you in your locality.
Yeah, exactly. It's a surprise.
I'm not an attorney, but I like to pretend I'm one on the radio.
Yeah, well, I'm licensed advisor, and I can't pretend to be an attorney, so I always have the disclosures there. But
did you stay at a Holiday Inn last night?
yeah, exactly.
Amazing how that marketing works, doesn't it?
That's funny.
Yeah, so, okay. Now, when someone, okay, so let's say, let me give you a hypothetical.
Okay.
I am, because I'm not this, but especially not the age part I'm going to give you. But let's say, for example, I am a divorced mother of two. One's an adult child, one's a teenage child. I'm in my 50s, and, you know, I've, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. I've clawed my way up through the ranks. I knew that building wealth through real estate was the way to go, and so I started out simply by buying my first fourplex. I lived in one, rented out the others, and then I used fabulous FHAs to continue to buy and move up and move up. And now I've built quite a portfolio, and I have like four fourplexes, so I've got 16 units I got rented out, and I have my own house, and I'm living comfortably on that income, even though I still actively work. And I'm thinking that, all right, you know, I'm not getting any younger. A friend of mine, my same age, just dropped dead. And now I'm starting to think maybe, I don't really have a plan, and I haven't really said anything to my children.
Yeah.
And my dad used to say to me, I'm not going to tell you how much life insurance I have because I don't want you to knock me off. So I don't want to discuss it actively with my children, but I need to create some solutions. So what's my first step?
Well, I think the first step is to do something, at least have a conversation with an attorney and make it a very well-qualified attorney. Just to quantify that or qualify that statement a little bit better, there are attorneys that do estate planning kind of in addition to other types of work. The more they focus on estate planning and the more full-time they do it, probably the better chances are that they're really in that business. So have a conversation at least. The first thing that I think of estate planning, and like you said earlier, in terms of either dying too soon, dying on time, or even living too long. And the risk of living too long means long-term care. So I think of somebody has maybe in this case you have a 100% real estate portfolio. Unless there's enough income to generate for that sort of care, you really need to help provide for that risk somehow, either by having some assets aside, you really need a lot of assets for that, or by having some sort of insurance for that. So I think of that in terms of protecting an estate, because that's going to protect it for you, the single parent, and also for your children down the road. And then I think of about succession planning for the property. If you pass and you've got your home and your four pluses, and very good chance that your children may not have the same interests you have, that they have their own career paths and so on, and they may not want the real estate that you've built. So probably the best thing to do is to go ahead and have a conversation with them, see what their priorities are around their interest in your assets, and then go from there.
Well, let's talk about the terms of that conversation and how to structure it right after these messages. You're listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, this is Coco Brown from the hit radio show The Truth with Coco Brown on HollywoodOutlaws.com radio. And you're listening to me on Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
Hi, it's Marty Logan here from the Top Gun Sales Academy. You know, one thing I've learned over the years is that the most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Naturally, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, and Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside. They knew they could easily become. Truly, financial coaching can be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation, 1-866-966-9420. That toll-free number again is 1-866-966-9420, or simply visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K-Free Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, industries.com. Like, go there, totally.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Rich R. Zaga on Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. And right before the break, we started talking about, okay, well, maybe we need to have that conversation with our chitlins. And who, I mean, it's such a tough topic to talk about. Plus, you're coming to terms with your own mortality, or worse, your incapacitation. And I think that that was always one of the comments that my father would joke about, that he was always worried not if he died and what happened to his stuff, but what would happen to his stuff if he didn't have the mental wherewithal, and would we just lock him in the closet, or would we actually take care of him?
Well, that's an option.
Yeah. He was so funny. I mean, some of the things that he would say. And then when my father actually did die, there was no will. There was not all the stuff that he talked about. He never did. It was the weirdest thing, and there was nothing.
Yeah.
It was a strange deal. So rather than leaving your children with that, oh, my God, my dad didn't leave me anything, he must not have loved me, or any of that stuff, how do you open the conversation? Do you do it with all the kids present, or do you just do them one at a time?
Well, you know, I think what you're saying is a really fair statement, that a lot of people aren't wired for this sort of discussion. And it's just that they're not comfortable with it. They're not sure how to proceed with it. You know, it can get kind of clumsy. They're afraid of the discussion. So I think that's a really valid point. If you think about that, and it really means that the parent has to enter the danger. What that means is that they have to enter a conversation that they're not very comfortable with. So, you know, it could be done with some help. I mean, there's some good advisors out there that can go ahead and provide the structure for a conversation like that. There's some good attorneys out there that can do the same thing.
Like a worksheet, make sure you address this, this, and this.
Yeah, and you know, I've had a couple conversations in family meetings where the advisors are part of the meeting and help kind of the parents have the discussion. I even had one very proactive parent have a phone call. Now, the kids are scattered around the country, and so he had his advisors on the call, he had his kids on the call, and the concept was that he pretended that him and his wife passed. So they were gone, and we were having the first conversation after they passed with the kids and the advisors. Now, the parents
were... That's amazing!
Well, it was amazing. The parents were listening, so they're hearing what's going on. But we carried on our first discussion before they died. It's the concept, Stephen Covey concept, you know, kind of think about the, you know, have the end in mind. Yeah.
One of my favorites.
It was a great discussion. And when he wanted to ask a question, he would simply text me the question he wanted to ask. And so he'd come from the dead, I guess, in that conversation and be able to. It was a great experience.
Were any of the kids, like, really greedy or trying to take over? That's what I would want to know. Which one of my kids wants to stew me in?
You know, as that didn't come out, but what came out is that the two children were not friendly before the discussion. And then during the discussion, it was, you know, things kind of came together.
Really?
Yeah, it was quite interesting. Even everyone knew that they weren't really dead. It was a really good exercise. So I would say, you know, if you can do it on your own, think about it, organize your thoughts. If you need some help, get the help. You know, you're not out there on your own. But it would be good to have a discussion and not be. Now, you don't have to get specific in terms of dollar amounts. It'd be good to get general in terms of concepts, real estate, you know, versus cash. Most kids really like the cash. Most kids feel that they can do a better job than their parents. Whether that's true or not, it's a
don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. But whether that's true or not is something totally different. But people really want cash. Liquidity is really important. Very few times do I actually see somebody like the hypothetical you gave who built real estate, pass it along, and the children are really that interested in that. It doesn't happen that often with real estate.
Yeah. When you have a real estate portfolio, can you give us, because I can't believe it, we've been having so much fun, we flew through the time. Can you give us, you know, two or three great questions that you can ask your potential estate planner to see if he's the one for you?
Yeah. I guess the first question to ask is, part A, part B on the first question is, you know, what percentage of their work is in estate planning? And then what organizations or associations do they have in the area? And if somebody is 100% and they belong to the local estate planning chapter and, you know, and they're actually participate in that, they contribute their time, that's a pretty good sign. Go on their website. You can see if they do one thing or many things. So I would say if you could focus more on somebody who does, because it takes a lot of work, and there's a lot of attorneys out there who just do it as a part of many things they do, and they don't do a great job on that. So there's one thing. The second thing for real estate attorneys is to ask them what their experience is in helping people with directly held real estate, you know, in terms of estate planning, and listen to them and see if they really do have the experience. If you have the experience as a real estate investor and they have the experience, you can tell very quickly by the issues that they address. If they're very broad and they really don't address any specific issues, that's probably a red flag that they really don't have, you know, that your asset class in mind. They don't have experience with that. I would say ask for referrals, but I would say more importantly than that, perhaps ask other attorneys for referrals or other advisors. That's a nice way to get into somebody who's a little bit better qualified than the average.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I walk in to my estate planning attorney, after I've interviewed a few of them, I've figured out which ones I like, which ones made me feel comfortable, which ones answered those questions, and I've elicited the right responses, and they make me feel comfortable, and I want to go in there. As a real estate investor, what questions do I need to ask that I, my bare minimum protections that I need when I go into estate planning? Give me three things that I need to pay attention to first and foremost.
Yep. The first thing is the will and the trust. There's a couple. It'd be two wills, one will per person and then the trust for the family. The trust might be a little bit over in the next couple of years, might not be as important as it was last year because of the change in the state tax law, but still.
Mm-hmm. Steinbrenner got one on that one.
Yeah. Yep, so it'll change. So some attorneys are still insisting that people create the AB trust for the future. So the first document is really the wills and the trust, and I look at them as, you know, kind of one unit. The second document would be an advanced health care directive, and the third is a power of attorney. Those are really the three main documents in the estate planning conversation that you should have. The advanced health care directives, what happens if I can't make decisions on my own health, you know, who steps in and helps with those decisions? And normally that's different than the person selected to help with the power of attorney on business matters or financial matters. Very oftentimes the person who is good at that, who's a very good person selected for that for a family, is not the same person that would be the advanced health care director.
Yeah, because they'll be like, pull the plug, hurry.
Yeah. A perverse incentive, yeah.
Come on, yeah. I got to make rent this week. Pull
yeah. That's right. Normally it's not. The reason is different is because one person has a good business sense, but maybe less empathetic.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the empathetic person maybe doesn't have the business savvy to help.
They've been around long enough. It's good.
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
Well, it's been such a delight having you on the program, Rich. And if folks want to find you for additional questions or estate planning, how can folks get a hold of you?
Yes. Well, you know, thanks for asking. My website is my company's Cornerstone Wealth Management in San Ramon, California. And people can feel free to visit our website, www.cornerstonewmiwealthmanagementincorporated.com. They can always also call here if they like. It's 925, area code 824-2880. Those are probably the best ways to reach us. And either we'll pick up the phone, we'll respond back to email from the website, and we're happy to help. And thanks, Heather, for having me on the call today. I appreciate that. I enjoyed this. A lot of fun.
Oh, outstanding. Well, I appreciate you taking time out of your weekend. His contact info is also on our website, unlockyourwealth.com. So surf over if you want more contact information for Rich. As always, we feature all of our show guests on the website. Go there for more resources, too, in today's featured strategy. Coming up, we have so much more in store, Minutes on Your Money, Millionaire Minutes, and then the whole second hour of our Keys to Riches and our next guest on Unlock Your Wealth.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, industries.com. Like, go there totally.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You just finished listening to Rich Arzaga on Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. And information. Now, for those of you who are just joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. And thanks for stopping by. All of our previous show guests, if you missed writing down the links to their websites, are always available at our website at unlockyourwealth.com. If you haven't had a chance to do so, please take a moment to pop by at unlockyourwealth.com and sign up for the electronic magazine, which gives you a weekly compendium of the Saturday show. And it will give you tips, tricks, tools, and information you can use to get yourself through the week until we have our next Saturday show. So it's now time for some minutes on your money. And the Associated Press writes, offering options but not answers for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Obama administration is laying out three broad options for overwhelming the mortgage lending system, but he will let Congress make the final decision. The Treasury Department says in a report released Friday that the government should withdraw its support for the mortgage market slowly over 5 years or more. The report describes a path for winding down the troubled mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The three options are to end the government's role in guaranteeing most mortgages, support the mortgage market only in times of stress, or provide a government guarantee for mortgage investments created by private companies. Now, under any scenario, the private sector will assume the greater role in housing finance. As the government scales back its involvement, the government currently owns or guarantees more than 90% of U.S. mortgages. The bailouts of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have cost taxpayers nearly $150 billion with a B as in boy, that's a lot of money dollars. Now, here's, God, you know, I guess, here's where my stress comes, all right? This isn't about, and you know me for your regular listeners, for the regular listeners, you know that I am not a pro-government supporter. These were quasi-public organizations. They weren't fully government entities. Now, here's the challenge that I have with this, okay? What happened to Fannie and Freddie has to do with them not following their own rules. Why is this our fault, okay? And why are they putting these stupid regulations on? They're acting like somebody did the wrong thing. The banks didn't do what they were supposed to do when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac chose to loosen the underwriting guidelines. Here's where I get all stressed out, because now the whole point of them was because they were supposed to be a safe and secure option. And again, I could care less one way or the other because taxpayers are paying for this. And this was ridiculous because of what happened. But it was their fault. I mean, this isn't, you know, the bank's fault, which I know that many people would like to believe or to accuse. But this is their fault for telling banks, okay, we're going to lower our underwriting criteria, which is just nuts. It's their fault, and now they're overreacting. This whole, like, 30% down for a mortgage thing is a little bit of an overreaction, too. Homeownership will not ever be what it once was when it was great or what it rose to right before it popped. And it's like a pendulum. And the pendulum swung so far loose that it's swinging back past center to excessively rigid. But, you know, I just have to wag my finger and say, shame on you, because we did our best in the 90s to self-regulate, or, well, some of us tried to regulate our industry, and I said, look, we need to legislate or be legislated upon, and nobody knows our business better than us, so what the heck are we thinking? By not taking action just because it's good. That doesn't mean it's going to be good forever. And they all called me Chicken Little. Well, yeah. The sky fell. Nobody wanted to know that. So according to this, they are sidestepping the explosive question where the report comes after years of debate about how to end the government's role in housing, and the options have been discussed for years as well. So I guess you need to know what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is before we go much further. Because here's what you don't know about Fannie and Freddie. They don't make loans, okay, you go to a bank, and the bank underwrites your loan according to their guidelines, Fannie and Freddie's. And then after the loan is approved and funds, then the individual bank sells the mortgage to Fannie or Freddie. All right, that's how it works. So they don't make the loans. They just buy and service them. There are tons of mortgage servicers out there. This just happened to be a quasi-government organization. Now, by handing the decision to Congress, the administration sidesteps one of the most complex and politically explosive questions facing the financial system. Any of the three options will almost certainly force mortgage rates to rise. It has to. But the money supply will tighten up anyway because just people won't qualify. So, but anyway, a near complete withdrawal by the government probably would end the popular 30-year fixed rate mortgage, or at least make it more expensive, and banks would prefer adjustable rate mortgages that would fluctuate with the markets. They're saying it's also the end of the hybrid model, however. All three options maintain some level of government support, either through guarantees or through existing agencies such as the Federal Housing Administration. Now, when they talk about guarantees, what they're talking about is when the loans are insured, as in the case of FHA or VA. And the government insures the loan to a percentage. The government doesn't get stuck with the whole loan. Here's how mortgage insurance works. Now, with VA, Veterans Administration loans are different. Those are guaranteed, and FHA loans are insured. And it's just a matter of semantics because the government has to call the same thing 500 different names. Otherwise, it doesn't make them an effective government organization because they're not busy wasting bureaucratic taxpayer dollars any other way. But the only portion of these loans, and this will actually give you an idea of how truly scary this is, the only portion of the loan that's guaranteed is the top 20%. It's not 100% of the loan, and that's where most of this problem is. So that $3 billion isn't $3 billion of home mortgages. It's only 20% of them because it insures the top 20%. In the event that you do not put 20% down and have skin in the game and work to keep your mortgage alive, that's the whole point of a down payment, is to mitigate that one underwriting criteria of capital. You know, you put money in, and I put money in, and so you put money in, it helps lessen my burden. It makes me feel like you'll stick around. So I'll give you a lower rate of interest, depending on how much skin you have in the game. Well, the mortgage insurers only cover that top 20%. That's what allows you to put less than 20% down, is this mortgage insurance. Well, mortgage insurance got to be kind of expensive in the late 90s and at the turn of the century, and so in order to create the same effect of 100% financing, but to get you out of the mortgage insurance premium, folks did an 80% first mortgage and a 20% second mortgage. That's how people were able to get into homes with no money down. That was a bad idea. Unless you went with FHA, which had different underwriting criteria. And loan caps, you could only borrow so much money. It's for entry-level housing only, is what it's meant for. But nonetheless, that 20% was like a coupon that the bank who owned the loan, in the event that the borrower defaulted, could take that coupon and go get 20%, that top part of the loan, back to help them liquidate the property because they've got to foreclose. That costs money. Then they've got to clean it up because anybody's foreclosed on, they always trash their place on the way out. They take shit they're not supposed to take, fixtures and things. And then they use that money to help them mitigate the loss if they have to sell it for less than 100% of what they lent on it. That's what mortgage insurance was for. The problem is when these loans started going, they all went at once. The market couldn't handle it, so the value fell out. But they only got 20% of the loan amount, a lot of people, or up to. So if somebody had paid down, you know, 10% of their loan and the mortgage insurance was on there, it was only for the other 10%. So that gives you kind of a framework for how it functions. But so the government didn't take a big bite out of a few loans. It took a little bite out of a bunch of loans. Administration officials say that the proposal of a hybrid model of public-private companies that let the public be on the hook for billions when Fannie and Freddie fail. You know, I don't think people understand this. I just don't think they understand this. Freddie and Fannie were servicers of loans, so they bought loans from banks. And those are for conventional loans. Now, FHA never changed their underwriting guideline, but they did something stupid, and they lowered or eliminated the mortgage insurance requirement, which is being charged on every loan. And at its peak, during my lifetime in the mortgage business, it was at 2.25%. If you took an 8-hour home ownership class, a federally sponsored one and approved, which I was a home ownership counselor and educator, I was approved to teach those, you could knock 0.5% off of that to 1.75 if you took the class. It was a pretty cool deal, because it explained the rights and responsibilities, home ownership, maintenance, all sorts of stuff, proper budgeting, so you could ensure your success. And the rate of recidivism, meaning that the loans that defaulted, was very slim for the folks that took this simple 8-hour class on the weekends. It's pretty amazing. But they got rid of that home ownership class requirement to reduce it. They just lowered it. And then they lowered it again. And I thought, oh, my God, what are they doing? That kept the skin in the game. For when folks didn't, it lowered affordability, so people were truly buying at their current ability. But they got rid of that. So you still made your payment to XYZ Bank if you had an FHA loan, because they only insured it. Same thing with VA. Fannie and Freddie were the only holders of mortgage notes. The only holders of mortgage notes. So, I mean, you got to get that little background in there so you understand where we are with this. And I think that this is a joke because it's their own damn fault. So, and they're not handling it correctly because, again, they're bureaucrats. And so, well, why would they? So on to brighter things, since we're in the middle of tax season. How about 6 ways to avoid an audit? Now, it may not be due to something you did wrong. It may not even be triggered by an IRS error. But there are ways to reduce the chances of getting that dreaded letter. According to MSN Money, the key is to minimize your exposure. Here are some things you should try to avoid. First and foremost, math mistakes. The biggest reason people receive letters from the IRS in addition or subtraction goose. Fortunately, math errors rarely lead to a full audit. Still, double-check your math before you send in your return if you're penciling it out by hand. And if you receive a letter from the IRS saying that you owe money, check your numbers first before having a knee-jerk reaction. Sometimes an IRS employee misreads one of your numbers, or the number is keyed into the IRS computer system incorrectly. The agency is wrong. Send a letter with a printout of your calculations. One of the things that I got in the habit of, because of being in the mortgage industry, when processing loans, you have to set it up for the underwriter. When you calculate payroll, you must do it with a register tape, because if people are paid weekly, you have to calculate the monthly amount, and there are 4.3 weeks in every month. So you have to add up all of those weeks together, then divide by 12. Same thing if people are paid biweekly, because you get 26 paychecks. You get like a couple extra if you were only paid twice a month, which would be 24, or monthly, which would make it super easy to calculate. especially if people get commissioned income, you have to average that income too, because one month it's $1,000, the next month it's $5,000. And we always had to calculate our work on a register tape and then tape that register tape onto the paper holding the copies of the canceled checks that are required. You need 2 months worth of canceled checks when you do a mortgage, or at least you used to. We're having an upcoming guest talking about what the new mortgage guidelines are, and it doesn't sound like they're pretty. But again, this is everybody's fault for thinking that they deserved something they hadn't earned, and they thought, well, I'll go 100% down and I'll take advantage of these extra low rates on this adjustable rate mortgage because value always goes up. So anyway, that aside, let me get off that tangent again. But we had to use a register tape and tape it into the file so the underwriter who was underwriting the file and evaluating all the information and contents therein could see how you came up with that number. It was like a second way to verify it. He would run his finger down and match up the numbers on the paychecks to the numbers on the register tape to confirm that, in fact, that was the correct answer. So simple little math mistakes like that. Or use a software. If you use a software that, and there's so many different kinds now, and there's online versions of it that you can pay for. If you have a simple return, that could be a simple way to get the math part right. Now all you have to do is type correctly. So don't drink too much coffee so you're not too jittery and you're missing the keys. Number two, mismatched interest and dividend reporting. If the amounts reported in supporting documents don't match the amounts on your return, you'll get a letter. There are lots of possible errors here. Sometimes the IRS will enter Form 1099 information, which would be investment interest or other non-wage income, into its computers and erroneously key that income amount for the Social Security number or recipient. If the income isn't yours, get a letter from the bank or other payer and forward that letter to the IRS. The amount is incorrect. Send a copy of the form 1099 mailed to you by the tax by the payer, meaning whoever paid the taxes and said that you owed it. That one's a tricky one. I had issues personally with this one, which created a significant amount of stress in my life because taxes were misreported for me back when I was in high school, which I didn't have a job. Well, I had a job. I was a cheerleader, but I didn't get paid for it, and I certainly didn't go to high school in Pennsylvania living in Arizona. That's a little bit of a commute. Wouldn't want to ride my bike that far. So I kind of just blew it off because I figured, oh, well, the IRS will figure it out. And guess what? They didn't, and they seized my assets. Because I called them, and they said, refile your return. And I'm like, how can I refile if I never did file? So I blew it off. I said, yeah, whatever. I was a minor, right? Wrong. So pay attention to that and work to resolve it. Number three, you're on the IRS hit list. Those who receive much of their income in cash are traditionally on the radar. For IRS agents looking for unreported income, be prepared to defend any non-income deposits in your account. Recently, the agency has also pinpointed small business owners and the self-employed. Too many business cars were going to campus each September. Be prepared to substantiate your deductions. Number four, also that you have a big mouth. This is one way to avoid an audit. Never brag about how much you put one over on the IRS, especially on Facebook. The IRS has been successfully trolling social media and looking for folks that brag about their unreported income and nab them. IRS whistleblowers also can earn rewards of 15 to 30% of the tax collected, including fines, penalties, and interest. Now think about this. You got any friends that are broke? Watch your back. They might be looking to make some moolah, a quick hit, for ratting you out.
It's easy. All you have to do is file a report using Form 211 or calling the IRS fraud hotline. So keep your accounting in line. And number five, you're exceptional. The IRS program compares your deductions with others in your income bracket and weighs the differences. So it's much like the way a credit score is calculated. The secret IRS formula called the DIP score is used to select returns with the highest probability of generating additional revenue through audits. Check programs like TurboTax's Deduction Finder and books like How to Pay Zero Taxes to ensure you're getting all the savings you deserve. And number six, you have the wrong preparer. Let's face it. Some taxpayers are less than professional. Some, unfortunately, are crooks. If your preparer promises you a refund before checking all of your paperwork, run as fast to the hills as you can. That preparer is going to be taking illegal or inflated deductions, and when the IRS finds out, you're going to be the one who pays the bill, plus interest and penalties. Although, on the other hand, you may qualify for a report if you report your criminal preparer to the IRS fraud hotline. Making money. Make sure you're withholding the right amount using a program like TurboTax's Paycheck Analyzer, or check the circular from the IRS. You can download a copy from the agency's website. Because this show is focused on bringing you the latest information, we actually subscribe to the IRS's newsletters and bulletins about changes in the tax law. Now, if they are coming to hunt you down, and I'm still in the middle of an audit that started over a year ago, call your tax professional. Here are some three survival strategies. If the audit is simple to prove your charitable interest deductions, for example, you can do it by mailing the IRS copies of your substantiation. For all in-person audits, they strongly suggest professional representation, and that's what we have because they know things that I don't and, frankly, don't have the time to learn. And it's worth paying them versus paying the IRS. You know me, I'm not a fan of my Uncle Sam. Plan your taxes to preempt an audit. If you think you have a huge medical deduction that you feel would increase your chances of being audited, attach copies of your bills to your return. The IRS computer might still kick out your return, but when a real person looks at it, all of the evidence will be there, and it will keep you and reduce your odds from a full audit. One of the things that I always did when I filed, when I had simpler returns, is I always sent copies of everything. To lottery tickets I was deducting that I lost money on, you name it, copies of the whole return, never the originals, but just the copies of all my documents. And I figured if I just overwhelmingly be like, yeah, this person gave us everything, they can't be trying to hide something, versus just sending in the return. I figured that out. Because I filed electronically once, and the flag went up, and they started sending letters. After that, I started printing out my returns, sending in all the supporting documentation, and it doesn't seem to happen as much that way. And make sure that you keep your records for 3 years. Normally, the IRS can audit you for 3 years after you file your return. In reality, however, most returns are audited within 18 months. This gives the IRS time to do the review and request appropriate substantiation before the statute of limitations expires. The IRS has announced that it will not audit a taxpayer for more than 5 years in a row on the same issues. Personally, that doesn't give me much comfort because once the deadline is passed, the IRS normally cannot audit your return and your expenses are insulated from examination. But file at the last minute if you are concerned about a potential audit. It won't hurt and it might decrease your chances of being selected. Why? Because everybody waits till the last minute, so they're overwhelmed, so they just are busy key punching. So the only way you're going to get popped is if that DIF score comes about. So the good news is if you are audited within 1 year of a refund or no change, it decreases your odds of being audited in subsequent years. In fact, if you're audited, on the same items 2 years in a row with no additional taxes due. The IRS manual specifically recommends not auditing you on the same item for a third year because clearly you're getting it right. We have so much more in store for you coming up on the Wagon Hogs Unlock Your Wealth Radio. We will be right back with our next guest, Danny Coffey. Be sure and visit the website for links to articles like these and much more at unlockyourwealth.com. Stay tuned for more right after this.
Are you a referral partner of the Unlock Your Wealth radio program? Would you like to promote your products and your services on our show? Learn about the benefits that our featured advertisers receive being part of an exclusive program where the listeners are seeking financial independence and are in need of your insurance, finance, real estate, and investment services. Call now at 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Reach the people who need your help the most with the Unlock Your Wealth radio show today.
Hey, this is Coca Brown from the hit radio show, The Truth with Coca Brown, on HollywoodOutlaws.com radio. And you're listening to me on Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth radio.
Hi, it's Marty Logan here from the Top Gun Sales Academy. You know, one thing I've learned over the years is that the most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Naturally, Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, and Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside they knew they could easily become. Truly, financial coaching could be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation. 1-866-966-9420. That toll-free number again is 1-866-966-9420 or simply visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, industries.com. Like, go there, totally.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagonhall on Unlock Your Wealth Radio, and the Shorty Awards voting has ceased. It looks like I personally, your fingers crossed, won in the entrepreneur category, and I think we finished in the top 20 for finance for the radio show Unlock Your Wealth. So that's pretty cool. And thanks to all of you who voted for us. That was That was a great deal. I'm so excited about all of that. Studio audience is a little slow on the draw this morning. Isn't that lovely? Well, I'm so excited about our next guest. He has an unbelievable story and an incredible book. Danny Kofke is currently a special education teacher in Georgia. He has also taught kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. Danny's love of teaching and finances led him to write the book, How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary. Danny has been featured in a number of publications, including USA Today, CNN.com, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, AOL.com, USA Weekend, Bankrate, Parade, Instructor Magazine, CBS Money Watch, Fox Business, The Wall Street Journal, ABCNews.com, Yahoo Finance, Women's Day, blah, 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 and a litany of others. More than 150 radio shows, television shows, and now, today, he makes his appearance on Unlock Your Wealth Radio. A lot of people think that figuring out financial matters and investing are difficult and intimidated by it. Danny wants to show others that if he, as a 35-year-old school teacher, can figure it out, they can too. So let's find out specifically what Danny knows about thriving on a teacher's salary. Danny?
Welcome to the broadcast, Danny.
Hi, Heather. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I'm so excited to have a teacher on that can actually say, and well, the proof will be in the pudding from our conversation today, that you can actually survive and perhaps thrive on a teacher's salary.
Absolutely. Not just teachers, too. And that's when I wrote my book. Obviously, the target audience was teachers. But then when the economy took a nosedive, I thought, let's just extend this out to those other careers that they get into it first and foremost because of the passion. Your nurses, firefighters, police officers, small business owners, especially at the beginning, to show them, you know, because we are hearing every day, it seems like, reading in the newspapers how tough times are. And I know that they are for a lot of people. But I feel this constant negativity just brings people down, and they say, gosh, if that person can't do it, then I can't either. I wanted to show a different story and to show that even if you don't make a large salary, and I think most would agree that those professions, I know a lot of people, like I said, are hurting, and some would think, gosh, it'd be great to make a teaching salary, but most agree it's not a large salary. It's, I'll tell you, this is my 11th year teaching. I make a little over $40,000 a year. So, you know, it's not nothing, but it's definitely in the median salary range. But I wanted to show them that they can still have a job that they enjoy, that they feel passionate about, that they feel a sense of purpose for it, and even if it doesn't pay a large salary, do okay financially.
And I think that, you know, there's a level of satisfaction and personal fulfillment through education. That's one of the reasons why I love doing my workshops and seminars. And my husband and I are co-facilitating a class at the U of A next semester, which is going to be here in a few weeks. I can't believe it.
I know.
Because there's a level of satisfaction that no dollar amount can replace as an educator.
Mm-hmm.
And after 10 years of service, if you were in even corporate America, you'd be close to, if not making six figures for that kind of a commitment to your profession.
Right. Well, the thing is, I've been there and done that, and I got the T-shirt. I got out of teaching. It was about 5 years ago. I had the chance to double or triple my teaching salary, and it was selling high-end flooring. Nothing wrong with being a flooring salesman. I think it's great, but my heart wasn't in it. And at that time, I had left teaching. I was teaching first grade. And for those people that don't know first grade, it's probably one of the most difficult grades, but also one of the most rewarding, where I would have students come in at the beginning of the year, not even really know how to write their name. 9 months later, they're reading chapter books. So just that part of it was so cool. So I went from doing that to not really caring if someone bought a $5,000 area rug. Like I said, nothing wrong if that's your passion, selling, you know, flooring. That's great. Have at it. But for me, it wasn't. So I realized quickly that even if I made $1 million a year doing something that I didn't enjoy, it would be fun to have that money, don't get me wrong, but at the end of the day, if I'm going and I'm doing something that it doesn't just bring me that joy like I get in teaching, I don't think that's a wealthy person. And I think if there is a silver lining to the economic mess that we are in, I think people are starting to realize that a little bit, that money absolutely is important, but when you base your job and the end-all be-all is just money, it gets old after a while. And you probably know people, I know people, that Monday morning rolls around, they're hitting that snooze button 5 times because they dread going to work. Even if you make a large salary, but you hate going to work Monday through Friday, just to me, that isn't the kind of life that I want to live. And for a lot of people that do that, those are the same people you hear the weekend, I work hard, I deserve blank, jewelry, cars, clothes, whatever. They buy something materialistic to give them that sense of happiness, but then we all know things become old. So after a while, those things that they buy become old, and they're in that vicious cycle that if they're needing those things to bring them happiness, they're just constantly spending money.
Well, I think people lose sight or don't really ever figure out that there's no amount of those things that are ever going to give them the happiness, but they think that they need more things.
Right.
And then more expensive things. And then they're bored with it before their first credit card payment is even due on those things.
Absolutely. Look at the average size of our houses and how the square footage-wise, and I know right now they're going down again because of the foreclosure rate and recession and what have you, but for a long time it was just increasing, but yet most of us say, gosh, we don't have any room in our house, so we buy a bigger house, and we stuff it with more things, and you buy a bigger house, and it's just a constant thing that we do feel like having things brings us happiness. I don't know if we're the wealthiest nation on earth, but we're definitely one of the top wealthiest nations on earth, but yet how many people have to go see someone for help or see someone because they're not happy? And I think it just shows that money, while it can take away a lot of worries, absolutely, it's not the end-all be-all to happiness. And there are plenty of people out there that are very rich, monetarily-wise, that are miserable. And at the same token, there are many people out there that may not make a large salary at their jobs, but they're very happy. There was actually, I don't know if you read it, it came out like 2 months ago, that they did a huge study, I think it was like 200,000 people, of what the average salary had to be for the ultimate happiness. And they came up, it was $75,000 a year. Now, you know, it's easy to see if you compare someone making $75,000 a year to, say, someone making $30,000, well, you can see why someone making that much would be happier. But at the same token, someone making $75,000 a year was just as happy as someone making $375,000 a year. And I kind of found that very, very interesting. I think it just shows that making $75,000 a year, definitely not a large salary, but for most of us, it's enough to pay for our expenses and to have some leftover for entertainment. And, I mean, these people were a lot smarter than I am, and they said this was the level of happiness where people, once you make more than that, your happiness factor does not go up.
I wonder what the criteria was that they measured that on.
Yeah, I'm not sure. You can Google it. It was a pretty interesting study when I read it. I don't know. It might have been surveys, random surveys to different people and different professions. I'm not exactly sure how they came up with it, but it was a pretty large study, and I know two people did it, and I think they were with a college, so it was pretty extensive.
Well, that's interesting.
I thought it was scary.
I wonder if they did a study like that between millionaires and billionaires.
That would be very interesting. I think that would be a cool study. I think so, too. I think they would probably find, which I don't know, I'm not, you know, in that field, but I know with a lot of people, when you look at the really, really wealthy people, a lot of them say, now, it's great to have the things that they have and be able to spend money and buy things, but I think for a lot of them, it's also the way that they're able to give back because they are in such a position that they can voluntarily do some things that others can't do. And that is what leaves their legacy in it. People remember them for. You think of someone like Bill Gates. Bill Gates has more money to buy anything he wants to buy, but yet when you hear him being interviewed, he's most proud of his foundation, which helps other people. Someone like Oprah. Oprah is most proud of the school she started in South Africa and things like that. So I think, and I know those are huge examples, But I think for a lot of people that when you are in the position that you can voluntarily be able to do things that you're in a position to help others, whereas, you know, a lot of us aren't, I think that's just a very powerful place to be. And when you are able to give back, and you were talking about it earlier, when you are in a profession or you're able to give back in life in some way, you can't really put a price on that. That's priceless. When you're able to better someone else and make their life a little bit better, there's no set dollar amount that can be placed on that.
I think it comes from Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And
yeah.
From the millionaires and the billionaires that I've had the opportunity to engage in conversation and pick their brains about all this stuff, the hardest part, I think, of Maslow's hierarchy is to get past all the material stuff and get to self-actualization. And I think that, and I don't think that 75,000 is that threshold. I think it's higher income-wise, but it's certainly the people at 350 are still busy wanting what they can't have, even though
right.
they have much more than many.
Right.
But there's somewhere, there's a critical mass that occurs, and I'm going to say it's closer probably to the $1 million a year, because I think that the value is intrinsic for them, because clearly, you know, Bill Gates will never spend all of the money he has. Even if he went on a rant page and spent millions every day, the interest alone that
You're
he's
right.
earning on his money sitting in a bank is he could never spend that.
Right, right.
Ever.
But it's interesting because some people that when you come from, and I'm not sure where Bill Gates, you know, his lifestyle, but I remember earlier this year I saw an interview with J.K. Rowling, and she, the Harry Potter author, and she was still concerned that she could lose her money. Now, you think how much money she has. She would have to do, I mean, she would have to make really, really unwise decisions and do some really foolish things, but she still was concerned about it. And I think because she came, I mean, a lot of us know her story where she was homeless and didn't have much money. So I think for a lot of people, too, that when they do come from that area, you might be right that who knows how much is enough. I think if someone like J.K. Rowling, if I had her money, you know, I'd be set. But she still doesn't feel that way, I think, because of the hard times she experienced. So maybe that plays a factor into it, too. I'm not sure.
Well, and, you know, you think of Maslow's hierarchy as this pyramid. And I almost think that you have to, like, it's not quite a pyramid. Like, maybe it starts getting narrower and narrower, but that last one, where you get to self-actualization, is more like those people that do the cliff, you know, climbing.
Right.
And
right.
and that it's not that continual ascent, but maybe it kind of juts back out at you. You've got to climb up and around and hang from your fingertips before you finally get over the top to
right.
self-actualization.
Right, right. Yeah.
Because
that is,
at that time, I believe that at that point, when you hit that self-actualization, that you understand because you've already gone through that materialistic accumulation of stuff that you figure out there's something bigger than this. And I think that's what Bill Gates figured out.
Right.
Is after, you know, he got it to a point where he could never spend all of his money, even if he tried desperately to do so. I mean, Microsoft makes more money than many countries' economies. I think it's like the 35th largest economy in and of itself, and it's only a company.
Right, right. It's interesting. That is kind of an interesting point with him because it shows. I think it's kind of a cool example that it shows that even in his life, he was able to have and still can have probably whatever he wants to a certain degree. I mean, I'm sure there's some things out there, maybe not, but for the most part, he can do and have whatever he wants, but yet he didn't hit that happiness point or that self-actualization point until he started giving away and seeing that there is something else out there rather than just accumulating more. Don't get me wrong. It would probably be fun to be able to buy everything you wanted. I think it would be a great feeling, but I think for a lot of people, it would still leave them empty. It gives you that happiness for a while. If I go out and buy a brand new shirt, the first 5 or 6 times I wear it, absolutely, it feels good. After 6, 7 times, the shirt becomes old. We've all been there. We look in our closets. I have nothing to wear today, but yet you have 50 outfits that at one time you bought. So I think that happens over time, that the things that you do buy, eventually they do become old, and if that's all you're basing your sense of satisfaction on, you're just in a vicious, vicious cycle of constantly having to buy things, and then hopefully eventually you just figure it out that, you know, this isn't it. This is not the key to definite happiness.
So, while it's nice to talk about Bill and all of his wealth and
right.
things, how can we make a difference in our own microeconomy on a teacher's salary? Where do you start? Because people are like, oh, my God, I wouldn't even know where to start. Where do you start in your money management philosophy as a teacher?
Well, the first thing that we figured out is, well, first, I mean, to go way back, we had a goal. My wife, Tracy, was a school teacher before becoming a stay-at-home mom. Now we have two little girls that she stays at home with them. Actually, my oldest is in first grade, but she's been a stay-at-home mom now for 6 years. So obviously, living off $40,000 a year, raising a family, it would not be possible or near next to impossible if we had a large mortgage, we had a lot of debt, car loans, whatever. So when we first got married 10 years ago, we had a plan, and we sat down and talked about it. We worked together as a couple that we hoped one day, when we did have children, that she would be able to stay at home. We weren't sure how long. This has kind of actually exceeded our expectations of how long she's been able to stay home, but we had a plan in mind. So during the 4 years that she worked before having Ava, we tried to live like we were living on one salary. When times were good, friends made fun of us, ha-ha, we pretty much tried to bank one paycheck and just live off the other one. We had one car for 3 years. I rode my bike to work sometimes. People made fun of me. We had a smaller house. We didn't go out to eat all the time like a lot of our friends did because we had that vision down the road of where we were heading. And I think that was huge for us because if you don't have a goal in mind or a destination in mind, it's very difficult to get there, and especially in our society where we are very consumer-driven. Madison Avenue spends billions of dollars a year to get our money, that if you don't have a purpose of what you're working towards, it's very easy to give in to that and to succumb to that pressure and then find yourselves years later not doing what you want to be able to do. So that was first for us. Then second on our path, I think a lot of people are in trouble because of those day-to-day expenses that add up quickly over time. Obviously, having a house you shouldn't be living in, driving too fancy of a car, those are givens. They're going to get you into trouble. But I think for a lot of people, it's those day-to-day things that they spend money on, but they just don't realize that they're spending it. Easy example, let's just say Monday through Friday during the work week, you eat lunch out. We're going to keep it low. We're going to say $5 a day. Fast food, as cheap as can be. Probably won't think twice about spending $5. You're not going to miss $5. But add that up. That's $25 a week, $100 a month, $1,300 a year. $1,300 a year on the teacher's salary can go a long way. So the first thing that I recommend to people is to don't hate me because it's going to be difficult, but walk around with a piece of paper and a pencil for 1 month and write down all the money you spend. Anytime you buy something, write it down and write how much it costs. At the end of the month, you're able to analyze this paper. It's your handwriting. You don't need an elaborate computer system that could fail. Some people can use it, and that's fine if it works for you, but here it is. It's your handwriting. It's not going to lie. You spent that money, and then you're able to see exactly where your money is going, because if you have no clue where your money's going, there's no way you can have it work for you. People would be surprised. Even when we did that, going out to the movies a couple times a month or going out to dinner or breakfast, whatever, most of us in our lives, we have areas that we overspend in, and it may not be a lot of money, but over time, it can add up. I think right now, for a lot of people that I talk to, it's cell phones. Now, if you need a cell phone for work and you need to always be connected to the internet, then have at it. But I've talked to stay-at-home moms that say they don't have any money, but yet they have the newest iPhone and they're always connected to the internet. And I think, well, you do have the money. You're just choosing to spend it in a different way. And I think by writing down your expenses and writing down how you're spending your money, you'll be very surprised. And like I said, most of us in our lives, we do have a few areas that we overspend in. And let's face it, there's only two ways to have more money. Either A, you have to get a higher paying job, which unfortunately it can be done, but it's a little more difficult than it was to get a new job 5 years ago. Or B, cut back on what you're spending, which in essence puts more money back in your wallet.
That's great advice. You know, I think about the people that have the widescreen TVs, yet they complain that they don't have health insurance.
Right, right. It's all about decisions. I mean, that's the bottom line.
You made a choice not to have health insurance because you'd rather
waste away in front of a television set.
Right. I mean, there's things I want. Don't get me wrong. If I see someone driving a BMW, I want it, absolutely. But at the end of the day, I tell myself, I can't have it. But either, A, I'm going to have to get out of teaching to get a higher-paying job, been there, done that, didn't like it. B, I'm going to have to get a second job, and I'm never going to see my family. Or C, Tracy will have to go back to work. And in the 6 years that she's been a stay-at-home mom, so far there has not been one item that has made us want to change our lifestyle. So I think that's the thing for us, is we always tell ourselves, we can, and maybe it's just a play on semantics, but we can have it, but this is what's going to happen if we do choose to get it. And I think that is where a lot of us have gone wrong over the last 5, 6, 7 years, where we always think, okay, our house is always going to go up, so if we get in trouble, we can tap it, or we're always going to get that raise. We never really think about the future consequences of the decisions that we make, whereas we always try to weigh that in, that if we do this, then this is going to happen.
And exactly. You can have it all, but you don't necessarily need to have it all at once.
Right.
And what are you willing to give up if you're not willing to work harder or longer?
Right, exactly. I mean, with us living on $40,000 a year, it's hard. We probably can't go out to eat dinner every single night. That would be very, very difficult to do. So we just have to pick and choose. Okay, we'll go out, you know, maybe once every 3 weeks we get a date night or something like that. So we can't do it every night. And I think that's another reason where a lot of people got into trouble. We're used to, as a society, it's kind of an all or nothing, that we want it all at once. And if you can, have at it, great, have fun with it. But for a lot of us, we can't do that. And I've come to realize that because we don't do it all the time, those times that we do, we really enjoy it a lot more because we don't take it for granted. We know when we get to go out to dinner, just the two of us, that it's a treat. It's absolutely a treat. This isn't something that's given. We're not used to it, so we enjoy it. So I think if we kind of get into that mentality too and realize that we do have a lot of blessings and just think, okay, some of the things, we don't need everything. Bigger is not necessarily always better, and I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have figured that out the hard way.
Agreed. And unfortunately, at the financial cost of our entire economy, and us taxpayers are subsidizing those people,
I know.
They're not learning lessons, unfortunately.
Right. I hope they are. That's my goal. And maybe I'm too optimistic with this, but I hope that right now, if you can't pay your mortgage or you're not able to pay your electric bill or put food on the table for your family, it's going to be horrible. That would probably, as a father, as a provider, that would probably be one of the most horrible feeling I think I could feel. But I would definitely in myself say, you know what, I'm never going to let this happen again. I'm going to make that change, because for a lot of people, unfortunately, it takes them falling down and hitting tough times before they do make that change. 10 years ago, there were plenty of financial advisors, professionals out there that spoke the same thing that they're saying today, but more people are listening right now because they have been beaten down and they've been hit with hard times. So that is my hope, is that people actually learn from this. I look at people from the Great Depression. Now, they may not have a 5,000 square foot house, they may not drive a Rolls Royce, but most of them have enough money in the bank that if something happens, they have enough to cover 3, 6, 12 months worth of living expenses, because they experienced times that were really, really tough. They know what it's like to wait in line for food or not to be able to make ends meet. So that's my hope, is that people that are struggling right now and are going through tough times, that they're going to take this as a wake-up call, and they're going to ensure that they never have to go through this again.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I know.
I'm more of a realist, just because of all the people that I saw coming through the doors when I was doing mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the one thing that I have learned about people through experience is that people will not change until the pain of change becomes less than the pain of staying the same.
But I don't think
people were made uncomfortable enough. They're like, oh, well, I'll just walk away and I'll just go get another house.
Right. No, you're right. I go back to when I taught a preschool. I taught a 4-year-old class before I got into teaching, and while I was still in college, there was one little boy, every single day he'd run up the front of the slide. Every day, don't run up the front of the slide, don't run. Finally, one day, I'm like, you know what? I could care less. Go run up the front of the slide. He ran up the front. He slipped. He banged his chin, came down. You know what? He never ran up the front of the slide again. He always used the stairs because the pain was greater than the gain for him. So I think you're right that people do have to feel that pain in order to make the change. And it's unfortunate. And with all the bailouts that are happening, some people, unfortunately, aren't – they're not feeling enough pain, I feel. I've always been – I see people that, you know, are able to walk away or they're able to get a loan or whatever, have things modified. And I think, gosh, you know, here I am that we were smart when we moved. We bought a house that we could afford. I could have bought a $400,000 house if I wanted to. I could have been financed for it. But, no, I chose to live within my means and not do that. So I do think that – there should be some pain. I mean, if you have an iPhone, that should probably be taken away before you get more money. Or if you drive a car that's newer than 5 years old, sorry, you're going to have to switch. Things like that that I wish maybe were taken into account. Or if you are getting some sort of aid, maybe you need to go to a month of counseling or learn how to handle debt better. Maybe some classes set up that are going to teach you, and then you're going to have to show that you actually learned those lessons. Because, unfortunately, I kind of hear where you're coming from, whereas unless the pain is great enough, people really aren't going to change. And if they get bailed out all the time, why change? There's no need to. That if you didn't feel any pain, you're going to continue to do what you're doing right now.
Yeah, and I see that. I mean, and I see that in all sorts of areas. I see it in parenting. I see it in interactions between employees and employers. People just don't. They're not motivated as much by pleasure as people are motivated by getting away from pain. Because we dangle carrots all the time. There's incentives for everything everywhere. And the challenge that we have is that it doesn't matter because so many people, more than 90% of people, are not motivated toward pleasure, but they're motivated away from pain.
True.
And
true.
So that's why, because the pleasure is fleeting, and they've figured that part out, hence the need for more and more things.
Right.
Because it becomes like a drug or an aphrodisiac, and they have to go get more and bigger and better in order to fulfill that need. And when people continue to lend, they think, oh, okay, well, and then just keep going. They just
right.
keep going. It doesn't occur to them to stop because no one has said no up until this point. And then
right.
when they hear no, they just go around you. I remember so many times that people would come to me for a mortgage and they would, you know, they wanted this bigger house. And I'm sorry, but you can't afford that. It's not in your ratios. And they're like, well, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you could do this and this and this, but you have, you know, child support that you pay out. You have alimony that you pay out. You don't get any extra income in. You've got this many bills and this. While technically your income supposedly could afford a mortgage payment of this size, you are carrying all this extra debt, which
right.
doesn't make your ratio. So what do? They would go, well, fooey on you.
Right.
I don't want to buy the smaller house. They go down to the lender down the street that would do like a low documentation loan or a stated income loan, and they would overstate their income and assets to be able to live that way, to
right.
continue to paint a facade that wasn't really there.
Right.
And then when
it gets hits the fan, they get to walk away, you know, and just let it get foreclosed on. So, yeah, you're right. Where's the pain there?
Right. And what's amazing to me is all the people that they're trying to impress are just as broke as they are.
Oh, absolutely. It used to crack me up. When we lived in Florida, and when I used to ride my bike to work, it was an area where no one, we didn't have bike paths. It wasn't an area where people rode their bikes. Everyone drove their cars. And, I mean, I got made fun of, and it was, I could care less. I had that goal in mind. But I always thought, you know, the people that are making fun of me, they're broke. They don't have any money. So if they're making fun of me, then I must be doing something right.
Yeah, you know, I gave up a car for like a whole year, and I lived out in the boondocks, but I was day trading, and I created like this whole business, and when my car lease was up, I said, you know what, I don't ever want to spend money on that. I just want to pay cash for the next car. And my husband at the time thought I was crazy, and I'm like, well, if I need to use the car during the day, I could drop you off at work and then do what I
right.
needed to do and then come pick you up. What would be the problem in that?
Right.
And I rode my bike everywhere, and I loved it.
And everybody made fun of me because I attached baskets to my mountain bike, and they're just like, that's so not cool. And I'm like, well, how am I going to cart crap around?
Right, right. And, you know, and that's the thing, where people can get to that level where they don't really care what people think about them, then it's just such a cool place to be. And like I said, I mean, if people that have no money are the ones laughing at you, well, you're doing the right thing. You shouldn't want to be, have them be envious of you, because then you'd be spending money that you shouldn't be spending and buying things to impress them. So to me, when you're able to live the life that you want to live, it really doesn't matter what other people think, because you're getting such internal satisfaction from it that I could care less what someone thinks about me, especially someone behind closed doors is probably in debt. They're probably having trouble sleeping at night. There's probably a lot of arguments. On the outside, you might have that white picket fence and the two kids and the dog, and it looks pretty, but on the inside, it's a nightmare. So that's where I think, too, people hopefully are starting to realize that, you know, who cares what your neighbors think? And even if they appear to have everything put together, a lot of people don't. They put on false appearances, make themselves seem bigger than what they really are. And to me, you know, if you can sleep good at night and you know that you're able to take care of your bills, that's kind of all that's important. You're able to take care of your family, provide and support them. That's truly what matters in the long run.
Agreed. And I believe that self-actualization is achieved in that moment where you go, yeah, I'm on a bike, and you're in a car that you can't afford,
mm-hmm.
but I have the amount of money you're driving around wasting in depreciating assets. I've
right.
got that in the bank growing for me while I'm peddling my fanny to work.
Right. Well, and it's so interesting that people, and maybe it's not with everyone because I guess some people are impressed by it, but if I see people that I know that are in the same salary structure that I am and I know that they don't have money, if they go out and they buy, you know, a nice car, they buy brand-new shoes or nice purses, the ladies do, I'm not envious of that at all. I look at it, and actually it's the complete opposite. I think you're kind of foolish because you're spending money you shouldn't have. You definitely are not impressing me if that's the goal that you're trying to get across. So for me, it's almost the opposite effect, that if I know you don't have money and you're still doing foolish things, it's doing the complete opposite. It's actually making people have less respect for you when you're spending money that you shouldn't be spending.
Yeah, everybody, the one thing that kills me is like the luxury brand baby clothes.
Mm,
now,
yeah.
If you're driving a Honda or a Toyota, the likelihood that your baby should be wearing Louis Vuitton is slim and none in the real world, but somehow they feel like they're impressing somebody.
Right.
And I'm like, but you're my next door neighbor. I know you can't afford that, because I know that you didn't inherit a big chunk of money. I know you don't have
right.
a trust fund.
Right. And your baby's going to spit up on it and outgrow it in 3 months. So have fun with that.
Yeah, have fun with those. I flipped my cookies when I saw like some of this baby stuff that's all designer, and it's like $300 for a six-month-old to have a pair of designer jeans. And I'm like, really? Like, that's more
wow.
than what other people spend for full adult-size jeans.
Yeah, for the year for me, maybe, on my clothing allowance. I mean, that's just nuts.
Yeah, so
I know.
So I
know,
think that point of self-actualization is in that moment when you say, it doesn't matter.
Right. Absolutely, it doesn't. And I think it's such a cool place to be that when you know deep down inside, you feel like you're doing what you were meant to do on this earth. It really, no matter how much money you have or don't have, it really doesn't matter. Some of the happiest people that I know are clergymen or pastors. They don't make, I mean, most of them don't make that much money, but they're so content because they feel like this is what I'm meant to do, that they just have such a sense of peace about them. And I think it's just really cool to see that especially those people in the professions, they have that sense of peace that they just feel like, gosh, I was meant to do this, and the money will take care of itself. I'll be able to take care of my basic necessities, probably have a little bit left over to have some fun with. But when you feel like you're living your life the way that you're supposed to and what your purpose is, you're able to fulfill that, you can't put a price on that.
Agreed. And I really enjoy hearing your perspective, because you're out there, you're walking the walk. You're not saying, okay, well, I was a teacher and now I'm a millionaire, but I'm going to tell
right.
you,
tell you how it goes.
Right,
you're
right.
Still in the trenches. You're still living your word, and I find tremendous amount of value in that. So in your book, How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary, what would you say some of the more specific highlights are that people are going to find value in your book?
Well, I think it's a story of our life and how we've gotten to the place that we are right now. And I think just our journey, it may not relate to all because we took different steps than others were. We had different advantages that others didn't and things like that. But I think the overall process of just seeing how someone, like you said, is living the life, walking the walk, and the steps that we took to prepare ourselves to put us in the position that we are able to do it on $40,000 a year and have two kids, have no debt except our mortgage, still invest each month, have an emergency fund in place, things like that, that just an average school teacher, not a financial major, not a financial expert, I've never even taken a financial class in my life, but still has it figured out because financial matters, 80% of it, I feel, are emotional. The other 20%, yes, you might need a professional to help you out with the retirement and those types of things, but the day-to-day and most of it, it isn't as difficult as people make it out to be. So my hope with my book was I just wanted to show people some hope, but just show them a way that you can do it. Like I said, there's so many people out there that tell reasons why you can't do it. I wanted something different to hopefully help people, especially in these tougher times, to just say, gosh, this school teacher, most people know a school teacher, and they realize, you know, we're just, I shouldn't say average, but, you know, we're usually wealthy. We're not usually, you know, way up here, high on the hog. Most people can relate well to teachers, and just to lead by example, to show them that if I can do it, then you can do it too.
Wonderful. Well, if people want to get a hold of your book, Danny, where would they go to find your book?
The easiest, if you just Google search my name, so DannyKOFKE, usually the first thing that pops up is my blog page, so you can click on that. You can see some of my media appearances, direct link to email me, direct link to order my book. But my book's also on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and a few other places as well.
Wonderful. Well, it was such a pleasure to have you on the show today. You're such an engaging speaker, and I hope the listeners really enjoyed having you on. If you didn't catch his website, you can always visit unlockyourwealth.com, and we have all of our previous show guests on there. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more after this.
Stay tuned for the second half of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio with the Keys to Riches, right after this.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. That was so great to hear from Danny Kofsky. And we're crushing it today, so we are going to get to our key right now. Thanks so much for staying with us, and for those of you who are just joining us for the first time, we are now at our Keys to Riches Financial Wellness Series section. And the Keys to Riches is simply a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but it also gives you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, all building wealth, all while transforming your current financial habits into healthy money management skills. And we do that 1 week at a time, one key at a time, as we explore ourselves and our money and what we need to know. And I'm so excited because Danny brought forth so many great things that we are going to be incorporating in today's Break the Budget Key. So for those of you who have just joined us, at the beginning of the season in our second key, we started our organic assessment. And what we were doing is we were just simply saving receipts. We weren't tallying them. We weren't looking at them. We were just collecting receipts. And we wanted to make sure that we had the beginning of a pay period and the ending of the pay period and the beginning of the month and the ending of the month. So we've been saving them for 6 weeks. We were told to stick them in this envelope and not look at them. If we paid cash for things, we wrote a cash receipt. If we gave our kids allowances, we put a cash receipt. We wrote on a sticky note and shoved it in the bag.
Now it is time to pull out of those receipts and complete that assessment and begin our break the budget. Now, I came up with this key because I liken budgeting to dieting. Budgeting is something that we go onto and off of, just like dieting. And it seems every time we go off of a budget or a diet, we make things exponentially worse because we gain back all that weight and then some, or we spend all the money we just saved and then created new debt. So instead of doing it that way, we must create a healthy savings and spending plan. If we want to be successful and consistent over time building wealth, this is how it's got to be done. Now, what is interesting about this whole part of what we do is it's actually a small segment, watching where the numbers go. Because, and I'll tell you why, because when we think about budgeting or finances or spending plans, and we think about our money, all right, it's not like we don't know to spend less and save more. I like Dr. Laura Schlesinger's guide to dieting. It's real simple. It's eat less, move more. And the same principle applies. We need to spend less and save more, but we don't do it. Let's be honest with yourselves. Don't make excuses. That time is over, all right? We don't do it. And there's a reason why we don't do it. We may not know what that reason is, and that's why we do this organic assessment, to figure out what is that reason that keeps us from doing what we should do, what we know to do, but choose not to do. And you're like, I'm not choosing this, Heather, but you'll find out as we explore today. Yes, you do. So what you need to do is go to the website today, and our featured strategy is the list of categories that you need to sort your receipts into. All right, so you're going to break this envelope out, and you're going to go to unlockyourwealth.com, and you're going to go to the featured strategy. It's free for key members for the next 24 hours. It's always available for our premium members in the vault. And download and print out this worksheet. This is going to tell you how to categorize your receipts. So all you do is go down the checklist. All right, and then you are going to add them all up, and you are going to figure out, and because receipts are dated, you will know when you spent that money and on what you spent it. And we can't decide how to create our savings and spending plan until we know what we're spending our money on, specifically when we're spending it, to figure out what the why is. Why did we do this? Was it an impulse buy? Was it an emotional spend? Was it a catastrophic event? And we can start asking all of these great questions, because as we do our where I'm at, which is a balance sheet, you're going to take everything that you owe. So for those of you that are just joining us, the instruction was to save all of our bank statements, all of our credit card statements, anything that went money in and out, all of this stuff went into the envelope without looking. And we weren't supposed to do anything different. We wanted to live our lives exactly as we were living it, because we wanted the most accurate snapshot of what we do with our money. And once we look at the balance sheet, what we owe versus what we have saved, we should have a positive net worth of something. If you do not worth, you're not doing it right. And there are reasons for that, and it's in all of those categories. What you need to do is look between wants and needs and figure out, where am I? Now, even though you weren't supposed to do anything with these receipts, your awareness of what you were spending, that radar went up. So you may already have an idea of where you're spending and why. And what you need to do is use our six-step reframe formula to create new alternatives so you can still have the same level of personal enjoyment, but do it in a more financially responsible manner so you can actually spend less and save more. Because there's only one way to become rich. There's only one way to create financial freedom, and that's to spend less than what you make. And unless you're going to go out and win the lottery tomorrow, which that likelihood is fairly slim, you need to figure out another way to do it. And if you can't go make more money, or like in Danny's case, he doesn't want to go make more money, he likes what he does, he has to make adjustments. And once we can do that, we take that and we create between our balance sheet and our goals, we can easily calculate where you're going and the path to get there. And what's the difference is how much is going out versus how much is coming in. And if more is going out than what is coming in, that's the first thing you have to attack, and you need to figure out why. And with those categories broken out the way they are for the savings and spending categories, you will immediately see what it is that needs to go and why. And what you need to do is observe what precipitates that expenditure. And if it's an emotional spend or a moment of weakness, how do you create that same good feeling but not cost you money? You just got to figure out what's the trade-off. It's the economic philosophy of opportunity cost. So our nuts and bolts for this week's key is our key statement is budgeting is like dieting and something we go on to and off of. And instead, we must create a healthy savings and spending plan for consistently successful money management over time. Our key affirmation is, I have and execute a healthy savings and spending plan. And our key action item for this week is to empty that assessment envelope and categorize everything, evaluate needs versus wants, make sure your What's the Difference worksheet is in the positive, and work on taking and creating the same benefit at a cheaper price. So that way you don't have to sacrifice, because when we feel like we're sacrificing, that's when we go out and binge after we give up too much. So we just need to reshape how we save and spend, and we need to do it just a little bit at a time. It doesn't have to be radical, because we want it to be successful. And that's your nuts and bolts for this week's key. I am so excited. We had some great guests, and I just wanted to thank you all for joining us. I want to let you know that I am dedicating today's show to a dear friend's son who went to heaven a little sooner than we expected. This show is dedicated to Roger Evans, and may his worldly pursuits continue in his next life. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Heather Wagenhals' Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I am she, your money mentor, saying finally, financial freedom can be yours at www.unlockyourwealth.com. Go out and make it a millionaire's day.